Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
10:12. Thank you, Doma T. By the way, the forecast 1 week from today is that they just changed it to some rain is possible on Saturday of next week, the 11th of November. That matters to me because I won't be here. I'll be at my son's wedding. Grant and Nikki are getting married, so I will, at this time next week, be recovering from the rehearsal dinner and party, and then, you know, sort of get myself all jazzed back up again for the wedding and what will be a busy and wonderful and lovely day. Congratulations to those kids in advance. And I'm not sure who's doing the show on Saturday of next week, but I will not be here. Hopefully we won't have this rain. If this is the wedding day for you or your family, sorry about that. What a lousy weekend. We really do need to have something that lifts us up. And yet, two things I want to start the show with. Actually, three we'll do in this first half hour. One is a couple of sound clips from the last time I talked to Meriwether Lewis and Thomas Jefferson on stage. There's an ad in the Chicago Tribune today about that, and I'll get to that in just a second. But first, Sam, you made me think of this when you mentioned that it was 1 year ago today that we had the parade. Was that the parade or was that the trophy ceremony at Grant Park?
That was the same thing.
Same thing, yeah. It was all the same day. It was 1 year ago today. I was on the roof of the Tribune Tower with Judy Pilak and Steve Bertrand and Andrea Darlis and all those guys and gals as we broadcast the parade that came down Michigan Avenue and ended in that great celebration at Grant Park. In tomorrow's Chicago Tribune, Mary Schmeek will have a column about what happened 1 year ago on Wednesday, and that was the presidential election. 1 year ago Wednesday. And Mary Schmeek's column, I won't read it all, but I'll just give you a taste of it because this describes many of you. She wrote, "Where were you the night Donald Trump was elected president? It was a Tuesday, almost exactly a year ago. Remember? Yes, you do. I'm guessing that the memory of that night is seared into the brains of most American adults, however they voted. But even if I didn't remember it, I have the texts to remind me. I found them in my phone the other day. November 8th, 10:34 p.m. Chicago time. A friend in California texts, 'This is terrifying. I know,' I text back. 'I cut off the TV and am in bed, feeling so sad.' 11 p.m. Chicago time. I'm still awake, lying in the dark, when another West Coast friend texts, 'Just sick,' quickly followed by, 'Just heard that the Canadian immigration site has crashed.'" She didn't explain. She doesn't need to. Later, Mary says, "In the year since Trump was elected president, the sun has continued to come up on schedule. Flowers still grow, trees still bloom, wailing babies enter the world, and their parents rejoice. People of all political persuasions still sing, dance, laugh. Some manage to love each other across the Trump divide. And the plane called America is still flying." But one of the last sentences of her piece is this: "It's been a long, hard year. A year forced us to reckon more strenuously than usual with the fact that liberty and equality do not exist on autopilot." That's in tomorrow's Chicago Tribune. You know, as sad as or as bizarre as that night was, election night for some, I suppose there were parties and gatherings of people who just could not believe their good fortune. They were high-fiving and clapping each other on the back, and it was the best night of their lives. Same night. There's an ad in today's Chicago Tribune. I think this is page 3, lower right-hand corner. It says, "Lewis and Williams and Bears, oh my." And then underneath that, it says, "An unscripted live conversation featuring John Williams and Meriwether Lewis about America's greatest adventure story." That would be Meriwether Lewis, John Williams, and the bears that the expedition might have encountered. "Lewis and Williams and Bears, oh my." It's going to be Saturday, December 2nd at 1 p.m. at the Blizzard Theater at the Elgin Community College. Elgin Community College, Saturday, December 2nd, we're going to be on stage. And this is Meriwether Lewis on stage telling us about the Lewis and Clark Expedition. That may not exactly light your fire, but I'm telling you, it's really a remarkable show. You get to ask questions, I get to ask questions. It'll be a lot of fun. I've done this conversation before. And, of course, they're always different. The last time we sort of talked about this was when I had Thomas Jefferson on stage. And I was asking him, because he's really the guy that sent Lewis and Clark off, what that was all about. I asked him about the danger that Lewis and Clark might encounter.
When Mr. Lewis left Fort Mandan in Dakota on April 7th, 1805, he was entering unknown country, terra incognita. And he actually said in his journals, "We are now about to penetrate a country at least 2,000 miles in width upon which the foot of civilized man has never trodden. We literally didn't know where the source of the Missouri River might be. We didn't know what sort of range of mountains would be the intervening ridge between waters of the Missouri and waters of the Columbia. We couldn't know what sorts of tribes he would meet, whether some of them would be hostile, whether they would meet grizzly bears that proved to be murderous to the men. And so the possibilities of starvation, of death by hostility, of death by natural causes, or becoming bewildered in that immense tract, all of these were very real. But I kept my usual optimism and assumed that Mr. Lewis would prevail, which he did, of course."
Did you wish that you could have gone?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in that I would have given anything to have been dropped by a hot air balloon for an afternoon somewhere. I can't sleep in the skins of quadrupeds. I cannot live without wine. I cannot live without books. I cannot live without scientific instruments. I cannot live without French cuisine. You know, if I had gone, instead of taking one 35-foot keelboat, they would have had to take three or four.
So then that's Thomas Jefferson on stage describing the trip. When we do this show, we'll actually have Meriwether Lewis himself in the first person describing the adventure of it all. And this is, again, Jefferson just relaying one of the more exciting parts of the adventure for them, as only Jefferson would have put it. Second track, Griff. So this is cut number two, Jefferson describing Meriwether Lewis and the gang.
At St. Louis, the river is a mile and a half wide, and nobody who was civilized had ever been to its source. And then a little more than a year later, on August 12th, 1805, Mr. Lewis had the extraordinary pleasure of actually drinking from the fountain of the Missouri River. So he had reached the actual source of one of the world's greatest streams. And this is what he wrote, I believe, August 12th, 1805. I think he said, "At the distance of 4 miles farther, the road took us to the most distant fountain of the Missouri River, in search of which we have spent so many toilsome days and restless nights. Thus far, I had accomplished one of those grand objects upon which my mind has been unalterably fixed for many years. Judge, then, of the pleasure I felt in slaking my thirst with this pure and ice-cold water, which issues from the base of a low mountain or high hill." And then Lewis pointed to one of his companions, a man named Hugh McNeil. He said, "2 miles below, McNeil had stood with 1 foot on either side of this little rivulet and thanked his God that he had lived to bestride the mighty and heretofore deemed endless Missouri River." Is that extraordinary? I mean, that he reached the source of the river and he bestrode it between his legs like a colossus from the ancient world. And then Lewis said he climbed over a little ridge, and on the other side he drank on the same day from source waters of the great river Columbia. And he said he had, as it were, knitted together this continent in his digestive tract. I find that very impressive.
So do I. That's Thomas Jefferson talking about the Lewis and Clark expedition. I want you to be part of that show. We're going to do it December 2nd at Elgin Community College. And the details and the tickets are at wgnradio.com/events, wgnradio.com/events. Go there right now. Tomorrow in the Tribune, there's a story, 50 Dumbest Things in Sports. 50 Dumbest Things in Sports. You haven't seen this probably yet, but I've got the page in front of me. Sam Griff, Domati, here's just some of what the Tribune says are the dumbest things in sports. Tell me if you agree or disagree. This is sort of a thumbs up, thumbs down. You ready?
Yep.
Cheerleaders at pro sports games, employing scantily clad women, often at ridiculously low wages, to serve as eye candy on the sidelines is indefensible and unnecessary. Cheerleaders at pro sports games, you're in, you're out. Sam, go.
Wait, you want me to guess the next one?
No, I want you to tell me if you agree with them on that.
Not really.
How about you, Domati?
I'm pro cheerleader.
Griff.
Maybe raise the wages, but a categorical dismissal I find unreasonable.
It's
no.
Weird because everybody seems to like it, even though it is a bit of an anachronism or whatever you call it. It does seem, in this day and age, you know, cheerleaders just seem to be out of place. But it doesn't bother me. For instance, when the Ice Girls come out at a Blackhawks game, I don't mind. When I see the girls at the women, whatever, the cheerleaders.
Well, I'm glad they started to come. I mean, they used to dress like Hooters girls.
They dress more appropriately now. Thank you, Mrs. McDonough, or whoever had a hand in that. But I think it all works. Number two, fighting in hockey. Dumbest thing in sport, yes, no. Panionovich, go.
I like the fights. I think they bring energy.
Bad, bad, bad. This day and age, bad.
No, I mean, they weren't that much better 50 years ago.
Stoppage time in soccer. You know where the game ends and then they keep playing? The clock reads zero, but because of penalties? Stoppage time in soccer. Isn't that crazy? I've never understood that. It's very frustrating. You're watching the game. They're down a goal. You don't know how much time is left. Baseball's unwritten rules.
Yeah, ding, 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 ding.
I agree with the soccer one.
Soccer one, stupid.
Unwritten rules are stupid.
So don't bunt to break up a no-hitter.
Yeah, like don't touch the chalk. Touching the chalk is bad luck when you cross over from the dugout to the field.
Those are all dumb.
Don't pimp your home runs. Stuff like that. Don't bat flip.
How about this one? Champagne celebrations after clinching a wild card berth. Yeah, you shouldn't be doing that. I mean, you know, that's not exactly the back door, but it's not the front door either.
That just sounds like jealousy. Because you don't get to do it at your job. They shouldn't get to do it at their job. No.
So what would that be, Griff? Like if we, you know, if there's
great show, just nailed the show. Pop champagne. We had some good conversations today.
Did you see that thing in the second half hour? Whoa!
So far, I think the fighting in hockey, to me, is the dumbest. I do think that's stupid.
Is ticket prices on the list?
We get to that. How about Super Bowl halftime shows? Overhyped and frequently disappointing. I completely disagree. I think it's an American cultural phenomenon. I love the Super Bowl halftime show.
Timberlake this year.
Yeah, it's going to be good.
No, it just depends. But there have been some really good ones in the past few years.
I think they've figured it out lately. How about you, Domati?
Super Bruno Bowl Mars halftime. Beyonce was
awesome.
Phenomenal.
Awesome.
Yeah, it is kind of hit or miss. But yeah, like Griff said, I mean, the past few years have not been bad.
And remember, Bruno Mars and Beyonce, that was actually Coldplay was the featured act that year, but they completely stole the show. Everyone forgot that Coldplay was even there.
Exactly.
Okay, one more and then we'll take a break. TV coverage of the NFL Combine. TV coverage of the NFL Combine. That may be the worst use of the spectrum in the history of television.
Yeah, that's just symptomatic of a whole other, I mean, that's a whole conversation of other stuff that doesn't need to really be
on TV or exist in America.
Yeah, that's just one of many, it seems like. But
guys
that
travel across the country and wear jerseys of their favorite team to watch.
In the fourth round, the Panthers select Smith.
I do not understand that. That's another breed of person I do not understand. A few more coming up next here on GN. All right, three more quick ones. Dumbest things in sports. I'll work this list with you guys throughout the show. Also, in the next half hour, we'll visit with the producers of a movie called All the Queen's Horses. How could one woman steal $53 million without anyone noticing? It's the story of Rita Crundwell, the city comptroller and treasurer for Dixon, Illinois. That woman took $53 million over the course of a decade or so, and nobody noticed. It's a stunning story. Dumbest things in sports. Sam, ticket fees, cutting box office staff and pushing fans to buy tickets online and then charging a convenience fee. I'm so glad they put that on the list. More than three uniform styles in a season.
Three? In baseball, they wear like 10 now.
I'm so done with that. I don't even like the pink bats anymore. And this one, just real quick, guys, your gut reaction to bullpen dancing.
Stupid.
Bullpen dancing. Griffin, go.
I don't know if I'm familiar.
When the Cubs relievers started the tradition of dancing in the bullpen after a teammate hits a home run. Sometimes even when their team is trailing a game. I don't mind that so much. I think it looked fun. I've, you know, those guys are so disconnected from the game in the bullpen anyway. I love that they're into it that way. And it's perfect for a Madden squad. So I'm okay with that. The thing that started to get on my nerves this Cubs season was the pretend TV interview in the dugout after the guy hits the home run. I thought that got old really fast, particularly, again, since we weren't always playing so well. So that's on my list of dumb things in sports.
As a baseball team, great job, Cubs, but as a sketch performing group, as a sketch comedy troupe, there are some improvements.
It's no Super Bowl shuffle.
It's no Super Bowl.
Well, really, and you know, like that thing where they interview in the dugout. Javi Baez was usually the one doing it, right? I think it was Javi. Fine, the first time or two was funny, but then it kind of grew bigger and bigger and bigger, and I thought that bit was getting older and older. It's 10:30. All right, we'll pause here. Domitee's going to do the news, and then we'll tell you the story, All the Queen's Horses. It's a fascinating thing. Coming up on WGN. Thank you, Domitee. 10:38, make it 39 now on WGN. John Williams in the Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue. Half hour from now, where will you be? We will be playing back part of our Mincing Rascals podcast. We broadcast part of it every Saturday at 11:10, a roundtable sort of news discussion with some of the smarter journalists and commentators in the city. And this week, it's for the first, this doesn't happen that often, but we got like 2 seconds into it, and Eric Zorn said something, and we said, all right, Eric, we're going to bust you on something you posted on Facebook this week. And then we took about 3 or 4 minutes just bringing him down and arguing about the appropriateness of Eric Zorn's Facebook post this week. You'll hear that in a half an hour. There's a new movie that you will be able to see at the Siskel Film Center. It's called All the Queen's Horses, How Could One Woman Steal $53 Million Without Anyone Noticing? It's the Rita Grunewald story. She was the comptroller and treasurer of Dixon, Illinois. You remember the story? That lady was piece by piece taking millions of dollars for years away from Dixon. They didn't have money for ambulances in that town. She stole $53 million from that town. And the movie was made by a first-time filmmaker, Kelly Pope, who's in our studio right now here at WGN. Kelly, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing good on this rainy day, but I'm doing great.
Congratulations on your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're an accountant by trade?
I'm a proud CPA by trade,
you
yes.
You teach accounting at DePaul?
I do. I teach forensic accounting and managerial accounting.
Oh, so tell me what forensic accounting is.
Forensic accounting is teaching students to use accounting techniques to investigate fraud.
So there you are, really interested then in this story.
Absolutely.
I mean, you would have been called upon to investigate something like this in your professional life.
I would have been. But when I saw it in the news, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a crazy story. Make a great documentary.
So give me the elevator speech. What did she do?
So trusted employee embezzles $53 million over 20 years and no one knows it. And so how does this happen?
What was she doing with the money?
She was buying quarter horses and supporting this massive quarter horse empire that she had for years. She was one of the number one quarter horse breeders in the country.
She was an attractive lady, flashy, wore pretty clothes, and had houses in Dixon.
And jewelry.
And jewelry. And tell me about the motor coach.
So the motor coach was pretty decked out. It had flat screen TVs, a waterbed, stainless steel appliances, wood grain furniture.
What did it cost?
Ooh, she bought a lot of them. So it got up into well over $1.5 million. So it was pretty nice.
Million-dollar motor coach. And this is in the, you know, no matter when it was, at a time when Dixon and the whole country is suffering, too.
Absolutely. So part of her fraud was in the height of the recession. So, yes, it was when a lot of people were suffering.
How did they not notice? So she's spending the money on all of this stuff, and people noticed her. What did her job pay?
So in 2012, her job paid $80,000 a year.
So didn't people think, well, that's weird that a lady that gets $80,000 has this lavish lifestyle?
Well, what's interesting is her two worlds didn't speak. So you have her equestrian life, and then you have her city life, her city work life. And those two worlds didn't cross. So it's not as though people would have, they probably thought in the city that she won money from selling horses or winning shows. But you really don't win a lot of money from that. It's a hobby. It's not necessarily a business. So those two worlds didn't talk. So it made it easy for it not to be detected.
You say in the film it also made it easy because she was singularly responsible for the financial handling of the city, right?
Absolutely. So one of the things we focus on is there's a lack of segregation of duties. She did everything. There's a lot of organizations that are like that, where you have one person that writes the checks, deposits the checks, balances the account, moves money around, and she did it all. So it made it easy to do it and hide because no one's watching.
So taxes are levied in Dixon, Illinois. Money comes into the city government. There's I presume, an account, right?
Several accounts. So the city had several accounts that were housed at Fifth Third Bank. And she was able to establish a secret account that no one else knew about, but she had power to do that because she was the only signer on this account.
But you'd think somebody would say, okay, the city took in $5 million this year. And that's kind of weird because the city was broke, right? Weren't they upside down?
Well, and I think from going back and forth to Dixon and talking to residents, there were questions, but they, who are you going to ask? You ask Rita, she gives you an answer, and that's the end of it.
There was the mayor, there's not another person who goes, wait a minute, but we took in $5 million, but the road project cost $1.2 million, and payroll was $700,000. You think that somebody could just ballpark, add it up, and realize they were short, considering how much money was being stolen from them.
True. However, I think Rita had a really good response. And oftentimes when you're the person that controls the finances, people accept your answer at face value because they trust you. You often know the finances better than they do, and they're convinced of that.
Also, they were part-time employees. I mean, the mayor, you pointed out a thing, like one of the guys on the city council who might have been responsible for oversight, he's a school teacher. This guy runs a carpet store. So they really weren't there 24/7.
Right. They weren't there 24/7. It was a part-time position. But it's all of this is why it makes for such a fascinating story.
Yeah. And sad, too. I mean, what was the city doing without as a result of her theft?
Well, there were layoffs. There were shortages of equipment and things that they needed. There were road repairs that never happened. So a lot of things did not happen in the city as a result of the missing money. It's a lot of money missing.
This is the largest municipal theft in U.S. history, right?
Yes, unless something happened about 20 minutes ago. This is the largest one.
So you compared it to the second largest municipal theft. To talk about that comparison.
So before this story, the largest municipal fraud was in Washington, D.C. Similar situation, trusted employee, $48 million over 20 years. The difference between those two stories is there was about 11 people that were involved in the D.C. theft, where the Dixon case is just one person.
And D.C., however grave $48 million is a large city with a large budget. You broke it down by resident. And in the case of Washington, D.C., was it $80 per resident?
Yeah, so we quote that it's $80 per resident and around $3,300 per resident in Dixon. So okay, a big
right.
difference.
You live in Dixon, Illinois. You say, what was the cost to me? It was $3,300 per resident that she stole over how many years?
Over 20 years.
20 years. I mean, the whole time she's kind of, everybody knows Rita Crundwell in Dixon. She was the lady in charge.
Yeah.
So you make the movie and you tell that story. Talk about the moment that her 20-year cohort, the assistant treasurer or whatever?
The city clerk.
City clerk. How did she discover that something was wrong?
So one day she was busy doing the treasurer's report for the city and noticed that she didn't have the bank statements from Fifth Third Bank that she needed. And typically Rita would give her a list and say, call the bank and ask for these specific accounts.
And Rita wanted it over the phone. She didn't want her clicking on a computer.
Well, their process was the information came in the mail. So this information was typically mailed to them. And so this particular day, Kathy didn't have the information that she needed.
Rita's out of town.
And Rita's out of town. She's at a horse show. So Kathy calls the bank frantic saying, send me all the information on the accounts. And they fax this information. And the secret account was on the fax.
And she goes, I know what that account is. I know what that account is. What's this 8502 account or whatever?
Don't know what this one is.
So she clicks through or finds out. And all of a sudden, there's $300,000 deposit. $400,000. All big amounts of money. And she has no idea where that money goes.
And Kathy talks about in her interview that she was terrified. I mean, this is her boss. How many people turn in their boss? How many people question their boss? Not a lot. So she was nervous and didn't really know what to do. And then finally talked to Mayor Burke. And here we are.
It's amazing that she was able to get away with it that long. I mean, if it's in a bank account and it's one click away from somebody discovering it, aren't you surprised that she was able to pull this off?
Not when you know there are no segregation of duties. When you have one person that controls everything, it's easy. And that's why we keep seeing this in the media so much, because when you don't have those duties segregated, it makes it easy.
The movie is all the Queen's horses. How could one woman steal $53 million without anyone noticing? It's showing at the Gene Siskel Film Center starting the 10th. They've already debuted it there, but you and I can go see it the 10th of November through the 22nd. And then hopefully it'll have wider release, et cetera, et cetera.
That's the goal. We hope so.
Okay, one other question about this after the break, and that is, so she gets caught. Like a dozen FBI agents show up, right? And they say, we want to talk to you, and the next thing you know, she's gone. But then what happened to the town afterwards? What did they think about it? And what happened, like, in terms of finger-pointing and blame? That's next on WGN. The Mincing Rascals will entertain you and kick around some of the current events a little after 11 o'clock. Domitee's got the news in about 7 minutes here on WGN. This is John Williams. In our studio is Kelly Pope. She's actually an accountant by trade. She teaches forensic accounting, among other things, at DePaul. But she was part of a program, Diverse Voices in Docs, where they are nurturing new filmmakers in the documentary style. And so with that funding and with an ambition, she made a movie called All the Queen's Horses. How could one woman steal $53 million without anyone noticing? It's the Rita Crundwell story and how she ripped off Dixon. It's showing at the Gene Siskel Film Center the 10th of this month through the 22nd. I watched this movie. It's, what, 75 minutes long? Is that all?
71 minutes.
71 minutes. It's worth the hour that you will spend there. And really, it's a cautionary tale, too. I mean, every... You know, Manuka City Council should go see this.
I agree.
And just go, you know, Bob's doing the accounting and Bob's clean, but we shouldn't have a system that allows one person to take advantage of the situation. So in Dixon, when the residents found out, what was their reaction?
Their reaction was shock. We did a screening, a community screening in Dixon last weekend, and we had almost 2,000 people that came.
Really?
And it was great. I was nervous because I wanted to make sure that they thought that I did a good job in covering the story. And just based on the questions that we had during the Q&A session, you could tell that there was still a lot of anger, but I think the documentary gave them a lot of resolution, too.
Were they met at the city council? Because, okay, this rogue employee is ripping them off, but where's the city council? Shouldn't they be held accountable?
I think they were upset with the council. I think they wanted to know, you know, where were you? How did this happen? I think they were curious about the role of the auditors. How did the auditors not know? I think they were curious about the role of the bank. How did the bank not know?
Has Rita expressed remorse?
So at her sentencing, the only thing that she said was she apologized to what she had done to her friends and family. That's it. I've written to Rita. She declined the interview. But
she's the Bernie Madoff of, what is that, Kendall County or wherever it is?
Lee County.
Lee County. Wow.
Yeah.
And then they had to start selling off her stuff.
Right. So the U.S. Marshal Service did seize her assets and started selling it actually before conviction. So her horses were sold, her jewelry was sold, clothing, trophies, all before she was convicted.
A motor coach. How much money did they get? They're down $53 million. How much did they get?
So they get about close to $10
million. Really?
After it's all said and done. So the town actually netted $40 million in recovery, which is rare in a fraud case.
How did they, you said $10 million from her estate?
$10 million from just the selling of her assets. But in a civil suit, the town received $40 million. So they sued the auditors, the bank, and a sole practitioner.
And those people had to pay? So the town actually was made almost whole on this?
Made almost whole in the civil suit, absolutely, which
How
is
about
rare.
That?
Which
wow.
is rare.
The movie is called All the Queen's Horses. This is your first movie, right?
So I have a company called Helios Digital Learning, and we produced an educational documentary about 5 years ago called Crossing the Line, Ordinary People Committing Extraordinary Crimes. So that was my first educational piece. This is my first feature doc. So.
Going to make another one?
I don't know about that. We'll see. There's lots of great stories.
How much money does it cost to make a movie like this?
Oh, it could... This was a pretty hefty budget for me, so around $435,000, wow. $450,000.
I'm going to do an investigation about that.
Come right ahead, bring
it on.
How
one woman came up with $400,000.
Begging a lot of people to donate and asking a lot of favors. So.
Can we plug Voices in Docs? What is that?
So Cartemquin Films started this program called Diverse Voices in Docs, where they are seeking filmmakers of color to come and join this fellowship program and really learn the inner workings of documentary filmmaking. And so I applied to their inaugural program and I got accepted and worked on this project through that program. And then after graduating, they came on as a co-producer, and the rest is history.
All the Queen's Horses. Check this movie out and let's follow the film career, or at least the accounting career of Kelly Pope. Kelly, it's nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Domati. It's 11:08. This is John Williams in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. We're here until noon. Then Amy Guth comes your way. We got the Northwestern football game, as you guys said, later this afternoon. 2 o'clock, the pregame. Dave Ennett with the call. Ted Albrecht right by him at 2:30 for the kickoff. By the way, just before the news, we were interviewing Kelly Pope. She's the woman that made that movie, All the Queen's Horses, about Rita Crundwell, who ripped off Dixon. And a text poured in saying, what a selfish woman. She should never get out of jail. So for ripping that town off of $53 million, how long do you think she goes to jail? What was the sentence? It was 19 years. If she serves all 19, she'll get out at the age of 82. She has to pay restitution. Even though the town was made whole, the judge then said, and then you have to give them that amount of money over again. So she owes the town $52 million that she'll have to start paying back when she gets out of jail. Actually, they're taking out of her prison paycheck, and it'll take about 100,000 years for her to pay them back at the $60 a week or month she makes in jail. But the sentencing goes like this. 19 years, 85% of which you have to serve. If she serves all 19, she went in 2013, she'll get out at the age of 82. I didn't ask that on the air, but I wanted to make sure you had that postscript to the story. So here's our Mincing Rascals podcast broadcast. We record a podcast each week at WGN Radio with Steve Bertrand. Well, they'll introduce themselves for you right now. We kick around current events. We do it each week. And if you like what you're about to hear, please subscribe to each week and listen to The Mincing Rascals. Here's part of the conversation that our roundtable this week had.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of the Wintrust Business Lunch right before John's show, Monday through Friday at noon.
I'm Krista McQuarrie with the Chicago Tribune editorial board.
Scott Stantis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune and creator of the Prickly City podcast right here on WGN Plus.
I'm Eric Zorn, the pure and blameless columnist for the Tribune. I write Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays.
Dude, okay, fine. I'm just going to say this at the start, and you don't have to comment on it or not. But I thought that what you put out there about Sarah Sanders looking like Fester from the Addams Family was inappropriate.
Uncle Fester, be respectful.
Yeah. Who are you speaking? Who are you speaking of?
This was a Facebook.
Oh yeah, pardon
post.
Me. And that was directed at Eric Zorn.
This was a thing was going on Facebook, and it was a picture of Uncle Fester and a picture of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and they had the same facial expression.
Yeah.
Did you have the same reaction, John, down the page where there was Grandpa and it looked like Ted Cruz?
I thought that was hilarious.
Well, what's the point?
And the one where Eddie Munster looked like Paul Ryan.
Same Widow's Peak, same hairstyle.
Right. And I think that's funny, and I have no problem with that. Why do I feel different about Sarah Sanders? I don't know.
Yeah, you do, because she's a woman.
I guess we're going to have this discussion, right, about all these sexual harassment claims that are coming out of Springfield and women constantly having to be judged on how they look. And I will just say I don't like when people post stuff like that. You can disagree with her on policy positions. I felt the same way about Hillary Clinton when people would call her, you know, make fun of her cankles or the way she looked or refer to her clothing or Janet Reno or any of them. It's wrong. And you can't be on one side protector of women and then on the other side be constantly mocking them because of how they look.
What bothers me about it is I think that in Eric's case, he can win all of the arguments. Eric can win the arguments without having to resort to mocking her appearance.
If I may stand in defense of my good friend Eric Zorn, I kind of disagree. I agree if you're making fun of a woman's appearance in general, if you're making fun of her weight or calling her ugly or something like that. But also, if we are going to live in a society where we are equal and you can caricature a man like Speaker Ryan and may call him Eddie Munster with no repercussions at all, I think if we're going to, I think we have to, there has to be a safe zone where women in the news also can be caricatured the same way.
Well, let me jump in and say, as an editorial cartoonist, I make fun of everybody. And, I mean, if you take away, you know, 50% of the population, then that's absurd.
So what do you think? All right, I get your point, but what do you make of what he did? I mean, it's a picture of...
I thought it was funny. It made me laugh.
Reclaiming my time. It was her resting Fester face that I think. I mean, I don't think she looks like Uncle Fester.
Was that a thing as opposed to
it
resting
is now?
Face?
It is now. I'm trademarking it. No, I mean it was just the coincidence of their expressions was very funny. I thought. I mean, that's why I put it up.
What kind of reaction did you get? And what did your wife say?
My wife doesn't look at my Facebook page. I don't think she had no response.
Come on, Eric. What reaction did you get?
She blocks her. She's very busy these days.
Did anybody else say what at least I'm trying to say?
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. On the thread of comments, there were people who were saying, like, don't make fun of her. Don't go there. Don't stoop that low. What's really important is how many lies she tells and so on. And it's ironic, of course, coming to the defense of this administration where they are always mocking people for all their physical attributes.
But how about it, Kristen? I mean, my point, I mean, if Scott Strong, a caricature of her, and it's exaggerated and she looks a little grotesque or something, should he not be allowed to do that because she's a woman?
I think, cartoonist, that's different. That you take liberties, that's what cartoonists do, is push the edges. I just don't like, in general, when people take women, whether it's Kellyanne Conway or, like I mentioned, Janet Reno, and make their appearance something to criticize. I just think it's wrong. And I would say the same thing about, you know, like people constantly talking about Chris Christie and his weight. Get over it.
Yeah, okay.
You know, like, deal with their policy positions that you disagree with.
I do think there's a difference there. I agree with you on that, making fun of someone because of his weight or because of her acne or something like that. But I will say that was a caricature.
It's juvenile. It is juvenile.
Well, nothing wrong with that.
Well, here's...
says the cartoonist.
Okay, so speaking of arguments or conversations we don't need to have...
This is from the guy who brings up Donald Trump Jr.'s tweets about his daughter's trick-or-treating. Go ahead.
And maybe who he blames for the terror attack in New York City.
No, when you have a president of the United States who his first reaction to a terror attack against us is to blame another American...
The senator from the state that
very,
happened.
In a thread that really doesn't hold up. I mean, I just think that's you have to point out that's an extraordinary thing. No president has ever done that before.
I have the same. It's wrong. It's Trump being misdirected at every turn and stepping in.
Every time you come to a fork in the road.
He takes the wrong one. Yeah. There's no defending him.
Eric, just jump in there. You've been awfully quiet today.
I have not been quiet.
Well, he was under attack from the president.
I kind of liked it, actually. Yeah. But what do you want to say?
I didn't know we were going to talk about that.
What he said was clearly off base. You know, this whole business, and also jumping in and declaring this guy deserves a death penalty. Yeah, that's informally what a lot of people are saying. He's speaking from the gut, but the guy deserves a trial. We have a rule of law in this country, and that's what it's founded on.
Yeah, the disdain that this president holds the criminal justice system is...
It's a joke.
It's
a sham.
He doesn't believe in it.
Well, he says it, and then Sarah Sanders marches right back out there and denies it. I mean, sometimes within hours of him saying so.
He exhibited this week how little he understands of the government he's running. Frankly, I mean, when he talked about someone asked him, well, would you send this prisoner to Gitmo? Yeah, I'll do that. You know, the fact is that terror defendees or terror cases in criminal courts in the United States are far more effective, far quicker than they are at Gitmo. Sending him to Gitmo would be a terrible idea if he wants to see this guy.
He tweeted this point you're making.
After he watched it on the morning talk shows.
I know, that's
when it came up. And the other thing is this thread that he hangs Schumer on. Is ridiculous. ISIS didn't exist when Schumer. No, let me just finish. If Schumer and others passed this lottery thing, since then Schumer was part of the Gang of Eight in the Senate who wrote an immigration bill that got rid of it.
Okay,
and it died in the House.
Steve, I'm not cutting you short. I just want to focus.
You
what
are.
You're
I've
saying.
Got more.
Well, then tell me more because I do not mind us talking about merit versus lottery for immigration. If we do, I think we should remember that based on merit, it's most likely that the 9/11 attackers would have qualified. They would have gotten in. And that the bigger problem isn't letting in terrorists. It's that we're creating them while they're here.
I mean, I don't know exactly what animated this guy. I know he was sort of self-radicalized, right? I'm not sure that we can say that.
I would say we are, but they're being created
while they are here.
I'm not sure that there were any red flags about this guy when he won that lottery. I mean, the thing that interests me about this, or the concern that I have, is how easy it is to kill 8 people by just renting a truck and driving down a crowded thoroughfare. I mean, he's very lucky. We're very lucky that it was only 8 people. We are very vulnerable in this society to all kinds of attacks. Like a lot of soft targets.
I would almost argue the same thing in a different way to where this, I think, is the beginning of where we see it's just normalized. I mean, this was a terror attack, and I don't think most of us, it didn't knock the country on its ass like most other attacks would. I mean, there weren't as many people killed, but it didn't stop and it didn't scare us. The little kids were walking by that Home Depot truck the next day going to Stuyvesant High School. So I think this is the beginning of sort of the normalization of these things.
It could be. And Zach Farden was the U.S. attorney who departed maybe a year ago from Chicago, Northern District of Illinois. When he left, he wrote a paper, like a white paper, on what needed to be done to reduce crime. And he talked about the need to perhaps infringe on people's First Amendment rights and what they're viewing on the internet in order to stop attacks. And I don't know that we're ready to go there as a country, but that might be the next step is, you know, if you are radicalized here and you are viewing things online, there is a way to red flag you. And we're very protective, of course, of our free speech rights. But are we going to just allow ourselves to be normalized, or are we going to be open to the possibility of government creep? I don't know.
Well, shortly after the president got elected, or maybe it was before, he was saying we need to keep these people from seeing this stuff online. And I think that was a little disturbing to people because it's such a broad brush that he's painting with there. I mean, does that restrict our access to the internet? But if they could, you know, narrow it down to some sites or some individuals and say
that is the worst idea in the world. I'm serious. I can't believe we're even talking about this. Seriously, we're talking about blocking. See, what happens, John, if all of a sudden the government decides that, you know, John Williams, he's inciting people to do, you know, whatever it is you incite people
Vote
to
Democratic.
Do. Yeah, and all of a sudden you get blocked. No, this is horrific. I can't believe we're having this discussion as journalists. That's insanity.
I'm just quoting the U.S. attorney who.
Okay, no.
If I may now back up my good friend Scott Standis. I mean, especially when you have a leader right now who wants to take away broadcast licenses from people who broadcast things he doesn't like.
Well, there you go again, Steve. That was just, that was a conversation that got too much attention. That was a one-off. Trump was mad at NBC, said we should pull their license.
Like which they don't
NBC
have.
Has a license.
Right. Oh, but that's his instinct, though. That is totally his instinct. I think it is something to pay a great deal of attention to.
Why does it smell like grilled hamburgers in here all of a sudden?
It does, doesn't it?
Yes.
Everybody and focus. Okay.
Let's move on.
And we did. Two other topics. Lots of fodder for thought there. You can hear the podcast in its entirety. We call it The Mincing Rascals. And please share it with your friends. We want to grow that as much as we can. Those people are smart and they're working for nothing. So I'd like their thoughts to go as far as they can. It's on my Facebook page, and you can subscribe to download for free The Mincing Rascals at the Apple Store, on iTunes, or wherever you get your finer podcasts. We call it The Mincing Rascals. It's also 11:21. This is WGN. It's raining downtown, not as hard as it was earlier. Lots of football games, of course, this weekend, and basketball is up and running, too. Sam Panionovic each week's picking five NFL games against the spread. And he's been doing really well, except for last week when he was 0-5.
Hey, you know what that means? 5-0 this week.
Did you win last night?
I did.
Or Thursday night, rather? Was it
the Jets? J-E-T-S. Jets. Jets. Jets.
Okay, so I got a couple sports questions for you. That's coming up next on WGN. Okay, give me the five games that you picked this week in the NFL. Start with the Jets. You had the Jets. They won. That's good.
Yeah, they beat the Bills. They were 3-point dogs at home. So 1-0. We've got four more. I got Tampa on the road getting 7 against New Orleans. Sure. I think Tampa is like an ultimate buy low spot. They've played pretty poorly last couple of weeks. So I got the Jets and the Buccaneers.
Tampa wins. Got it.
We'll cover 7. You can lose 1 through 6. Lose 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yep.
I got the Panthers -1 at home against the Falcons. I really don't like Atlanta this year. Usually when a team loses the Super Bowl that next year, they miss the playoffs. I think Atlanta's in a weird place right now. I don't like Atlanta. So Carolina -1. Two more. Which ones did I pick?
Well, you got to do the Bears.
No, they're on the bye. So.
Oh, that's right. Well, they don't lose this week.
Right. Well, they're the
bad.
Best team in the league against the spread. They are 6-2 against the spread, which is crazy.
Well, good for them. Well, I don't know what that means. Okay. So give me two more games.
Let's see. I'm trying to remember who else I took.
The Green
Chiefs
Bay?
-1.
Chiefs -1.
Against the Cowboys.
Root for the Chiefs.
And the Packers on Monday night at home +2.5.
Root for the Packers. All right, so we're rooting for Tampa, Carolina, Kansas City, Green Bay this weekend.
Yes, sir.
Sam Panionovic is picking in a national contest, fixed five games each week against the spread. He has been in the single-digit percentile across the country all year long.
Until last week.
Until last week when he went 0-for. But if he can go 5-for, he's back in the hunt for a $1 million prize.
Yes, sir.
Chicago Tribune on Sunday has a big story in the sports section. does it get any dumber? 50 of the dumbest things in sports. We've been talking a little bit about this. Cheerleaders at pro sports games, they say that's ridiculous. It should end. Bullpen dancing, they said. I still like the bullpen dancing the way the Cubs do it. They have this on their list of dumbest things in sports. Major League Baseball not assigning all season openers to teams with domes and warmer climates. The Mets, the Tigers, the Royals, and their fans shiver at home in late March. The Minnesota at the Target Field, they'll open up at home and play in Minnesota games in April. It's ridiculous. And yet there's the Astros and the Brewers playing road games at the beginning of the season. I've never understood that. I'm so glad they mentioned that. What else is on their list of dumb things? The golf police. The rules of golf are already convoluted and nonsensical. We don't need Joe Blow on his couch in Wichita calling the PGA and changing the outcome of tournaments.
Well, that's just insane.
Can you believe that's happened, though? That's what happened to both on the men's and the women's tours.
I don't imagine that this is on the list, but I would like to end the silence during golf shots.
Everybody else
whoop
has to play
up
with the noise. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, do they do that come at on the Davis Cup? Do they whoop it up during Davis Cup play?
Not when they're
pulling the club back.
Absolutely not.
But and I then think if they somebody should makes a noise, they all turn and look at you like, all right, who's the guy?
It's a free country. Deal with it.
I paid my money. So as he's actually pulling it back, you want to say, go, Tiger, go,
yeah,
hit it!
I don't think that's that popular of an opinion, though. I would also add to the list, yeah, and I don't know if this is on there, but baseball managers wearing uniforms. Incredibly stupid.
Yeah, although wouldn't it look weird to see Joe Maddon in a suit?
He doesn't have to wear a suit.
What do you want him to wear? Khakis, like, with a T-shirt or something?
Yeah, and then I know that might get dirtier than, like, NFL. What NFL coaches wear? I don't see why you can't. Or some in between. The fact that they suit up in their little uniform.
NFL coaches usually like slacks and a team fleece or
team
hoodie.
I think they look like slobs. I'm thinking of the New England Patriots coach.
But Belichick with the hoodie?
Yeah, I hate his look. I hate him.
Well, maybe they should.
Because all he does is win. That's why you don't like him.
Maybe they should wear uniforms too then. Maybe they should gear up.
As long as they don't wear uniforms in the NBA. That would be worse than baseball.
No, I'm on it in the NHL. I want to see Quenville in complete hockey gear sitting there.
Honestly, I don't think there's that big of a difference. It's just been normalized to us to see Joe Maddon in a uniform. But it's crazy.
Picture like the heaviest NBA coach in that tank and shorts with the high socks on and the Converse.
Well, that's it. They have to wear the clothes of their era too. So the tiny silk shorts, you know, for the older coaches. Maybe a younger coach gets to wear the big pants, but the rest of them have to wear those 1960s and 70s pants that we all wore. Yeah, with the high socks and the Converse.
Somebody just texted you from the 815. Grunting and tennis.
Yeah, that's a thing.
When they hit the ball.
I don't know that I should share this because I still want him to entertain me on the tennis court, but you know who does that a little bit?
Oh, who? I think I do know.
Carmen, Mark Carmen, when he plays.
Is he good?
Yeah, he is. And he'll get in a rhythm and he'll go,
whatever works. Whatever works.
But the thing is, when he's playing with me anyway and he's getting into his grunting rhythm, I'm only good for about two or three volleys. So it's not like he's really needing it because I'm going to hit it into the net on any given shot.
See, we've gotten into that territory again of, it sounds like, jealousy. He's better and you don't like the way that he's better. But I don't think we can trust that.
It's 11:31. We'll pause here. Griff's got a few things to bounce off of us. And I wanted to at least share with you the strangest story of the week about daylight saving. Thank you, Domity.
And I never do it, but it's not a joke. I can't tell the difference when I'm all alone. Is it real or a dream, which is worse? Can just wanted to go to sleep. Turn out the lights. When I turn out the lights, there's no one left.
John Williams here.
Sweet.
And Saturdays at this time, we ask producer Griffin to start us off with a song and then tell us some things that maybe we should be thinking about. We scored on a scale of 1 to 100, the questions Griffin asked. We call it the Vibe Score segment. What were we listening to there, Griffin?
Julian Baker.
That was good. I like that. Yeah,
22-year-old singer-songwriter with her sophomore album. That was the title track. It's called Turn Out the Lights. Came out a week ago.
I thought the string arrangements and some reed instruments and the multi-tracked vocals and piano give that music a chamber pop veneer, which allowed for a greater dynamic range. How about you?
Yeah, that sounds like something you would say. You just spitballing here? Or are you reading?
Greg Kot also had a mini review of that in today's Tribune. Yeah, that's pretty good. So I don't know anything about her. What's her name again? Julian Baker?
Julian Baker. J-U-L-I-E-N.
Is that representative of her? Is that what she sounds like?
Pretty much, yeah. Very direct, plaintive, emotional balladry.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
I think she knows how to build patiently to a knockout punch. How about you?
I agree. We had to cut that one a little short before the real
No.
You gave it far longer than you usually do, which I'm greatly appreciative of.
Because I was digging it. I think that it's still basically the work of a one-woman band centered on her voice and guitar, but I think she widened the production scope. How about you?
Oh, the scope of the production was very wide indeed, and I enjoy it. Yeah, 1 to 100, what are you saying?
88.
Yeah, I'm around there, too. I go 91. Domati.
I know nothing about music. Your eloquent words made me want to change my zero to a one.
Oh.
It sounds like the end of a bad romantic movie.
Yeah, these singer-songwriters do not go over very well usually with Domati.
No, I think that's what it is.
It's okay.
I think this album turned her previous intimacy into something far more ambitious.
Well, we got to... Once again, the words of Greg Kot, as beautifully spoken by John Williams. Sam?
It's obvious, isn't it? I mean, I'm not pulling... I don't even have a chance at that, Griffin. There's no way I can get away with
it. Well, even he probably wouldn't say it like that. You know, he wrote it like that, but he would talk like a person.
77.
77.
Yeah, it's pretty characteristic of the rest of the songs on the album, but the whole thing's worth a listen.
Julian Baker.
Very good stuff.
Thank you, Greg Kot. Okay, what else you got for us, Greg?
In theaters this weekend is Thor Ragnarok, the new Marvel movie. This has Chris Hemsworth, Kate Blanchett, Tessa Thompson, directed by Taika Waititi.
I only know this about that, Griffith. That's the guy that did Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah, he co-created Flight of the Conchords with Jemaine Clement and Brett.
How do you go from doing Flight of the Conchords to that?
It's a very good question. He's had an incredibly interesting career and made...
Flight is funny.
Hysterical.
And silly.
Hysterical show.
This
and he's a very funny guy, and he's made comedies since then. So he's made an indie movie early in his career called Eagle vs. Shark with one of the guys from Flight of the Conchords, and then went on to make What We Do in the Shadows a couple years ago, which had a bigger release and was very well received. It was a mockumentary about four vampires living in a house together. It was sort of like The Real World with vampires. Incredibly stupid.
What's the name of that?
What We Do in the Shadows. You really should watch it. It's incredibly funny. He stars in it with Jemaine and a couple other guys.
Very nice.
And he wrote and directed it. And then last year he made a movie called Hunt for the Wilder People, which is one of the best movies of last year. It was very funny and sweet. So he can do a lot. And this is always the question with these big franchise movies. Do you want super talented people as singular storytellers like he is?
To put their stamp on it.
To put their stamp on it. Or is it even possible to put your stamp on it? Are they just wasting their time producing something that is going to end up looking and feeling the same as all of them do?
I heard that there's some New Zealand jokes that are in there, some little asides that, you know, you either get or you don't, but the people down under are rolling in the aisles over those.
Yeah, I'm always conflicted when I see a filmmaker that I love, like Ryan Coogler's attached to make Black Panther coming out next year, which is really exciting. It's a huge, huge deal. And I love his previous movies, but at the same time, I'm like, I don't really love these Marvel movies that much. I'd rather maybe he was making his own thing.
Good reviews from this, though. I mean, okay, so what are you asking us here, Griff? I haven't seen it.
Yeah, go see it and check it out. I know you haven't.
Have you seen it?
No, not yet.
Okay, based on your review and what you've just told us, I'm giving it an 84.
Yeah, okay.
A little early, perhaps.
Yeah, no, well, maybe we'll come back to it. But people do seem to like it a lot. But you say the same thing every time with these movies. I don't know. Who's to say? There's a flattening that happens. Okay, in the viral category, I'd take you to the parade in Houston, the World Series parade.
Yeah.
Did you see this video of somebody took it from the crowd, and it's pointing up at a parking deck. There's all the people cheering, watching the parade from the parking deck. Someone had dropped their hat, and so they throw it back up from one deck to the next, because she's like on the fifth tier.
Oh, nice.
So they throw it up, and somebody catches it on the second deck, and everybody cheers, and then they throw it up again.
Nice.
And then they drop it, and then they do it again, and like it's a really entertaining minute, maybe minute and a half.
That's America coming together.
It was very
That's
nice.
That's kind of what it felt like.
Talk about pay it forward. This
did you watch
pay
that
it upward.
Dumpty or
I
Sam?
Did. I saw that. It was beautiful.
It's very fun to watch.
All right, so we'll put that in the viral category, and I'll post that on my Facebook page, too. I love that, Cliff.
It's way more fun to watch than it is to explain.
Oh, I think what you just said, I get it, though. I can see it. That's awesome. I love that.
And then you wonder, did it really end up with the right person? There's no way of knowing. But at some point, everyone's like cheering and, oh, it's over. I guess
Yay!
She got it.
But we did it. We did it. Hooray.
I want to double back while we're talking about sports to something we were talking about a minute ago. Managers wearing suits in the dugout.
Wait, suits or suits in the dugout? You mean managers wearing the baseball uniform?
Well,
or suits?
Yeah. No, no. Okay, so is it dumb that baseball managers wear the uniform of the team?
Okay. 100 is really stupid. 0 is not.
Yeah, sure.
100 is stupid. 0 is not. I give it a 14. I'm so used to it. I think it would look weird in a dirty dugout to see a suit-clad manager. And if he had to walk out and pull a pitcher in his street clothes, in his suit, that would just look bizarre.
Oh, you've fallen into my trap because we got a call from Pat. Thank you, Pat, for the call. He said, Connie Mack.
Yeah, he wore a suit and a top hat.
Yes. The longest-serving manager in Major League Baseball history.
Yeah.
In the 40s and 50s.
In the Stone Age, whatever.
Many years ago. But I'm looking at pictures of him now in a suit in the dugout. He looks great.
He managed from 1894 to 1950.
How do you know this, Sam?
I'm looking at it right now.
Oh.
Over 50 years.
So he managed for 56 years.
Wow.
So you might hear that and say it was a different time, so sure, he wore a suit, but it wouldn't be the same. But I hear this, and I look at these pictures, and I think he looks great. He's not trying to be something. He's not a baseball player.
All right, where are you, Domati? Baseball managers wearing suits versus uniforms.
I kind of like the uniforms.
Yeah, that's where I am on this
one. I think I like the uniforms. You make a compelling argument, though, Griff.
When I send you these pictures of Connie Mack.
We're going to change our mind?
Probably not, but
back when managers
something to see.
We're managers.
Can I ask you guys, just speaking of this, like you're either this kind of person or that kind of person. Daylight savings this weekend. We throw the clocks back.
Daylight saving.
You cannot care that I always say savings.
Daylight saving.
Daylight saving time.
I'm getting calls, so I just gotta pass it on.
You people need to just go to bed. So when do you want that hour of daylight? Because we can have what we want. At the end of the day, do you want to wake up and have more sunlight? Or do you want to come home from work in the afternoon and have more sunlight? That's what the argument is about. Where do you want that hour, Griff? When you get up in the morning
like
or in
the
evening?
In the afternoon. Because I kind of like going to work in the dark.
Yeah,
something
that doesn't
conspiratorial
bother me
about
so
it,
much.
I feel like. Or like I'm really getting a jump on the day.
Yeah, I like to come home to the light. When I was in Minnesota, it would be dark when you go, dark when you come back. It could depress you. There's a study about how that could make you depressed if it's too dark too often.
Yeah.
I want to come home to some sunshine.
How about you there, Mr. Sportsman?
On what? The suits?
No, we moved on.
Well, there's like three people in the office right now distracting me.
Never mind. It's probably more important what you're doing there than we're doing here. But Griff, do we have time if we take a break right now to play part of that interview that I did with the world's foremost authority on daylight saving time? We do, don't we?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, let's get
so
to
let's
that.
Go.
Did you have something else for me that you're
nope.
killing me that I didn't get to? It's 11:51 on WGN, so why do we even do it the way we do it in a minute? It's 11:54. There's just the funniest story on the CBS Morning News this week. They were talking about cranberry farmers in Massachusetts who want to extend the day by going to the Atlantic Ocean time zone because when we fall back, it's going to be dark earlier, and they want more daylight, which is weird because it makes it sound like if you go to the Atlantic time zone, you'll actually have more daylight, and you do not get more daylight per day by changing time zones. On the show this week, we called this guy who is the author of Seize the Daylight, the curious and contentious story of daylight saving time. His name is David Perot.
I'm in outside of Boston.
What a coincidence. You're at ground zero for this very topic, aren't you?
Correct. Just coincidentally. That's true.
Well, what do you make of what you've just heard my colleague and I say on the radio? It doesn't seem to me like it's really a solution when you can't create more daylight.
That is exactly right. And that is certainly, I can't see how anyone could think of that as a realistic reason to make any change. The goal of daylight saving time has always been not to add more daylight, because you can't, but to move the daylight to where it may be better for people that are on standard working hours. People like cranberry farmers, I'm sure, can get up when the sun rises, and so I don't think they'd lose an hour, whatever happens. But for people that have to go to work, the benefit of daylight saving time for most of the year is that it allows some extra daylight when you get home from work in the evening.
So that's bad reporting, but then the way you put it, it does make a little sense. I mean, if you're an office worker, you don't need daylight to harvest anything, but it would be nice to drive home with the sun still shining, so let's fall back.
Correct. That's the idea in most of the year. The problem that you get is the reason we don't have daylight saving time, I mean, this has been around for 100 years, so there's reasons for these things. The reason we don't have daylight saving time in the winter is because even though you would get an extra hour of daylight in the late afternoon, you would get very dark and cold mornings. And a lot of people don't like getting up in the pitch dark, going to work in the pitch dark.
Right.
Certainly don't like sending their kids to school in the pitch dark.
Well, so has there been, so you're right, you have a limited amount of daylight. So where do you want to experience it, at the end of the day or the beginning of the day? Is there a consensus on that?
The consensus basically is most people like daylight saving time for most of the year when there's enough daylight in the morning anyway. But when it gets to be the middle of winter and they'd have to go to work and send their kids to school in the dark, then they don't like it.
And that's the discerning point. You don't want to send your kids to school in the dark, so let's fall back and pick up the more daylight in the morning for the kids, even if you hate it getting dark so early in the evening. Longest weekend of the year. It's 11:57 on WGN.